Today we're basically going to be talking about the transverse shield Ising model, which is the prototypical example of a strongly interacting system, although we'll actually see that you can rewrite it in a way that's not strongly interacting. In some sense, the real introduction to strongly interacting systems is actually going to be in today's tutorial, where we're going to discuss the Hubbard model and the Heisenberg model. But I felt that it's better to put those things in the tutorial and then to talk about the Ising model in this context, because there's more steps that are kind of hard to predict, or if you haven't seen them before. So the model we're going to study looks like this. Sorry. Let me use a different notation. Okay, we're going to go this way. Okay, so what I mean by this term, of course, is actually something like the identity on site 0, tensor identity on site 1, tensor dot, dot, dot. To finally get sigma x on site I, sigma x on site I plus 1. And then more identity operators. So this is just a shorthand notation for this. And then likewise for the second term. So what does this model do? Well, let's understand what each individual term does. So the state, which I'll call right, where this right is equal to up plus down over root 2. In other words, the positive eigenstate of sigma x. This has energy minus j. Right, left has energy j. Left, right also has energy j. And left has energy minus j. So it tends to make the spins point parallel. The second term, having spin up, has energy minus h. And having spin down has energy h. So spins tend to point in the plus z direction. These are, of course, in competition with each other. And therefore, maybe we could expect the phase transition as a function of j and h. Actually, let me use the word. So indeed, this is going to happen. So let's try to understand the state of our whole system as a function of a parameter I'm going to call g, which is equal to j over h, because then j is just an overall energy scale. This is really the only free parameter in the system, this is g. So for g equals 0, we're going to have two ground states, which are degenerate. Um, which are all spins pointing to the right and all spins pointing to the left.
It's H over J.
It is H over J. You are correct. Thank you. Yes, thanks. Okay, so we have all spins pointing to the right or all spins pointing to the left. Or more precisely, we really have a two-dimensional space for which these are the basis vectors. So, and then in this limit, as g goes to infinity, in other words, j equals 0, the ground state looks like this. And then somewhere in the middle, we may or may not have a phase transition. So the two possibilities are, one, that there's a sharp phase transition from a phase which is, let's say, two-fold degenerate, has this xy spin ordering, versus a phase that's non-degenerate and spins point in z direction. Or it could be there's a smooth crossover and there's never any particular point where something special happens. A priori, we can't say right away that which one is the case. In fact, it turns out the answer is yes, there is a phase transition, which happens at g equals 1. So that's going to be our main goal, is to see that fact, and then to understand some features of this phase transition. So what we're going to do is actually a complete exact solution of the model, which is a fair bit of algebra, but works out pretty nicely. But before I do that, I actually want to try to argue why there should be a phase transition using symmetry. Or at least understand what the phase transition might actually be. So if you look at our original Hamiltonian that we wrote down, what you see is that H conserves total SZ mod 2. So the term sigma Z obviously doesn't change the z spin, so this conserves SZ. And then sigma x will flip exactly two spins. Therefore, also conserves SZ, but only mod 2. So one way of saying this is that H commutes with the product of sigma z on every set. So you can see that sigma z commutes with itself, and then if I have something like sigma x, sigma on I and I plus 1, sigma z, I plus 1, then this will give me something like minus I sigma y, but then I can cancel the two minus signs, and that's equal to I sigma y, which is equal to sigma z, sigma x, sigma z, sigma x. Okay, so we've shown that then this thing commutes with also the XX term in the Hamiltonian. Yes?
What do you mean by sigma x flips to that little spin?
So if I have like a state that's like this, and I act, call these states 1, 2, 3, 4, and I act sigma z2, sigma z3, the result is, this.
Sigma x, you mean?
Yes, I mean sigma x. Yeah, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, right, so then the fact that H commutes with this product of sigma z's is another way of saying that this is a symmetry of H. So the states that we wrote down earlier in the large J limit break this symmetry. And you can detect this by measuring an order parameter which is an operator that anticommutes with the symmetry. So an example is the expectation value of sigma ix because because this sigma x anticommutes with the product of sigma jc. So in this case, in the state, that's all right. Sigma x equals 1. And in the state where it's all left, sigma x is equal to minus 1. On the other hand, the state of all up has the expectation value of sigma x being 0 on any given set. So in this case means that when j is much bigger than h, or I'm going to just say h equals 0. we can observe spontaneous symmetry breaking. And when j equals 0, there is no spontaneous symmetry breaking. So at this point, I think there's a natural question that you should have. I emphasized earlier that the ground state, rather than having really two ground states in the g equals 0 case, what we actually have is a two-dimensional space of ground states. So there's something that I've skipped here. I evaluated the sigma x in each of these two states. But I could also choose just as well something like this. Right? And in this state, this sigma x will be 0. So this state does not exhibit spontaneous symmetry breaking. That's an equally good ground state. Our claim is really that spontaneous symmetry breaking could occur. But what we actually can do to detect it, even in this case, is we take our order parameter. Which I'll call O. And we compute the correlation function O on site I with O on site J. In the limit that the sites are very far apart. And if the state is ordered, this will be non-zero. Sorry, the intuition here is that if there was no correlation, then OI OJ is basically product of the excitation values in the two sites. And as I and j become very far apart, it's going to look more and more like this. So basically, this lets us detect this product of two copies of the order parameter. But in this case, it basically gets rid of the interference between the two terms so that this will evaluate to a positive quantity both in this piece and this piece, and the cross terms will vanish. And therefore, we'll get something non-zero even when I take this linear combination. Anna, do you have a question?
I have a question about the argument that all the parameter independence.
Yes.
And does this also hold for cases where there are continuous symmetry?
Continuous symmetry?
Yeah.
That's a good question. So let's see, I think the Heisenberg model. Okay, I'm not immediately sure. So maybe we can talk about that afterwards. Yes. Any of the viewers from afar have a question? Okay. Okay, so if we think about from this perspective, what do we mean to try to determine whether we have phase transition or not? I shouldn't erase this. So we know that over here, this what I'll denote as sigma x zero, sigma x infinity, just to say this is the limit that we take our order parameter evaluated at points infinitely far away part. This thing is not zero here, and here. This thing is equal to zero. So there are sort of two possibilities. One is that big sigma x is not equal to zero for all finite g. That is, the fact that this expectation value becomes zero only happens in the limit when g goes to infinity. That's one that we could have. And that would be consistent with this. I should say, I skipped one step. So this quantity we compute has to be a continuous function of g, because there's nothing that's not continuous in this problem. So if this is a continuous function that goes from non-zero to zero, it could be that it's only exactly zero in this far limit. Or it could be that there exists some point, which I'll call this GC for G critical, where this correlation function, or in other words, our symmetry breaking, is zero for G bigger than GC. So in this case, we would have a phase transition. In this case, we would not have a phase transition. You have a question?
So why does this function have to be continuous?
In essence, because the eigenstates are a continuous function of, or the eigenstates, the Hamiltonian is a continuous function of G. The eigenstates, okay, yeah, so if this were to be not continuous, you would have to have the eigenstates evolve discontinuously, like you make a continuous change in the Hamiltonian and get a discontinuous change in the eigenstates, right?
Can you rule out the possibility of that first one?
That's okay. That's a good point. Yes. Okay. Yes. You're right. So I've been a bit careless. That, in fact, this is if the eigenfunctions are continuous, okay, and then also, yes, as you point out, we could also have a first order phase transition. Where the eigenfunctions are not continuous. Okay, so that's also a possibility. Yes, you're right. So this it's one of these two as long as the eigenstates are continuous. The thing that's always continuous is the energy, but the eigenstates may not be. the string.
It's getting backtracking again with Jen's question about my order parameter should always anti commute with the Hamiltonian by with the symmetry. I don't see a motivation there.
Yeah, yeah, okay, that's true. I didn't say that because that actually wasn't in my notes, and I decided to add that at the last minute. So then I hadn't prepared to talk about it. But it's a good question. So let's say that let's suppose that an operator commutes to the Hamiltonian or commutes to the symmetry. So I'm going to say the symmetry is S. The operator I want to calculate is O. Then, and I'm going to say that S O commutes. Then, if I compute psi of O psi, this is the expectation value I'm trying to calculate, right? Then, because this S is a symmetry, I can transform. S dagger O S psi, because psi is equal to S acting on psi. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking backwards. Let's see. What do I want to say? Let's go.
In this case, X.
Yeah, that's right. But that's not the argument that I want to make. So that's why I'm. Okay, and yes, all right, okay, so right. And then I'm also supposing that we have, so we suppose that psi does not break the symmetry. Is that what I want? That's not what I want. Right, okay. No, this is the wrong argument. Okay, I don't remember the correct argument right now. So the rough idea is that so you don't really need an operator that. I think I have it. So okay, let's suppose that A anti-commutes the symmetry. So. Say this. Okay. And then furthermore, we have a psi, which respects the symmetry. Then this psi A psi equals psi s dagger a psi a s psi. Which is equal to
yes.
Minus psi a psi, which therefore is equal to zero. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, if I take the expectation value of an operator that anti-commutes with a symmetry in a state that respects the symmetry, I will always get zero. Therefore, if I take an expectation value of A in some state, which I don't know whether it respects symmetry or not, and I get something non-zero, then psi must not respect the symmetry.
So n, the order parameter, we want to check whether.
Okay, let me actually just write this out better. So now that I have remind myself how it works. Okay, so I'll write this out properly. So suppose that A anticommutes with the symmetry S. And psi respects the symmetry that S psi equals psi. Then psi A psi is equal to, I'll write it this way, S psi A S psi, which is psi S dagger A S psi, which is equal to minus psi A psi. So therefore, psi A psi equals zero. Okay, so this is what I said before. So now to put into words a conclusion is that if psi A psi is not equal to zero, then one of the premises is false. Implies that if we pick some AS, some A that anticommutes the symmetry, then any psi A psi not equal to zero implies psi breaks the symmetry. Yeah, okay. In principle, there's no reason why you should pick one particular anticommuting operator over another, but usually there's a nice choice of the simplest possibility. But you could ask our TA in the tutorial about this, because we're working on a project where we've been struggling to find a good order parameter because there's too many choices. Okay, so let me then continue back with the main story to remind us where we were. So we were talking about the different possible things that could happen, whether we have phase transition or not. So to answer this question, we're now going to actually just solve the whole model. Okay, so there is actually something faster we could do just to answer this question about the phase transition. There's something called a duality transformation that we can make, which has the effect of switching H and J, or therefore G and 1 over G. And that would prove that this one, possibility number one, is not possible. But that duality transformation, I think, doesn't tell us very much more than just that. But the exact solution will let us compute many more things, including some properties of this phase transition, once we ultimately see that, in fact, it does exist. So we're going to proceed in several steps. So first step is we're going to make what's called a Jordan-Vigner transformation. In the second step, we're going to do a Fourier transform. And in this third step, we're going to make what's called the Bogoliubov transformation. So I think all of these steps are kind of non-obvious. I mean, well, the Fourier transform one, that it's going to actually seem a bit more obvious, but they're still not quite clear. But the first step and the third step are definitely not obvious. And I can't really tell you like exactly how you would have come up with this the first time, but they're now well-established techniques and they're worth learning. So what the Jordan-Vigner transformation does, that's our first step, is it converts our Ising model into a model of fermions. So the starting point here is to notice something. So each spin lives in a 2D Hilbert space. And the set of states 0 that is unfilled and C dagger 0 that is filled for a single orbital also is two-dimensional. So maybe we can rewrite this space in terms of this space. So our first attempt is going to be to just do that directly. So we're going to make this analogy. We got the state up, go to the state 0. We got the state down, go to the state C dagger 0. And this implies that the operator sigma plus is going to be the operator that takes us from C dagger 0 just to 0. So this becomes the C operator. You have a question? Question? Oh, okay. The sigma minus operator is going to take us from this state to this state, so that's the C dagger operator. Then, of course, sigma x is sigma plus plus sigma minus, and sigma y is sigma plus minus I sigma. Right. Minus sigma minus over I. And sigma z. Well, okay, so sigma z should give us 1 for this state and minus 1 for this state. So that's going to be 1 minus 2 c dagger c. Which is also sometimes written as minus 1 to the c dagger c, or this can be written as minus 1 minus 2n, and this is minus 1 to the n. I'm getting ahead of myself. I'll come back to that later. But okay, so minus 1 minus 2n. So this is our first attempt. And on this site, it works great. But to be valid, fermion operators, they must satisfy our usual anti-commutation relations. And currently they do not. So to see this, let's consider we have two sites. We have site one and site two. Then C1 dagger, C2 dagger. If we follow our prescription back, so C1 dagger is sigma 1 minus, that's sigma 2 minus, but spin operators in different sites commute with each other. So this is sigma 2 minus sigma 1 minus, which is C2 dagger, C1 dagger. So that should be, they should have a minus sign there, so this didn't work. However, we can patch it. So the intuition is that spin operators on different sites commute because they are local. But fermion operators are non-local. The fact that I can take a fermion operator on site 1 and a fermion operator on site 2000, and if I swap them, I get a minus sign, that's clearly non-local behavior. So it means that we need to add something non-local. Okay, so the solution turns out to be that C dagger on site J is not just going to be sigma minus, but actually it's the product of all, on all sites L less than J, sigma LZ times sigma J minus. So I've taken what I had before and they added this string that acts on every site to the left of my current site. And then of course, in the same way, sigma J minus is going to be just the Hermitian conjugate, which is this. All right, I don't need minus, just CJ. All right, so now let's check the commutation relations. So let's make sure this actually works. So let's suppose I have CJ, anti-commutation relation with CI. So this is going to give me product of L less than J, sigma LZ, times sigma J plus product of L less than I, sigma LZ, sigma I plus, basically the same thing with I and J swapped, so now I'm going to assume that I is less than J, and this is just because this thing is symmetric in I and J, so it doesn't matter which choice I make. So assuming this, then I can write this as product of L less than I, sigma LZ squared, which is just identity, times, from the first piece, I get sigma iz, sigma I plus, sigma j plus. And then from the second piece, I get sigma I plus, sigma iz, sigma j plus. And then the whole thing is times the product of I less than L less than J, sigma LZ. So then finally,
sorry.
Yes, go ahead.
Plus, how did we get the delta JL outside delta L J square? The first term which we canceled.
This piece? So I use the fact, that spin operators on different sites all commute. And so if I look, at both of these terms, for every site that's less than I, which is less than J, I get a piece both from this product and from this product.
Nice.
Yeah. So all we're left, so basically, both these operators are non-local. In principle, this string goes to minus infinity along my chain. But as long as I have a combination of C, of two C's that are, you know, within some finite distance of each other, the part of the string that's outside of that range cancels. So we really just have a string between the two operators, which is important because it means that our, even though the fermion operators are non-local, we want our Hamiltonian itself to be local. Hamiltonian should only act locally. And what we see here is that if I have two C's together, then that is a local term because all the pieces outside of that range have canceled. Okay, so now the last piece is that we can see we're left with is basically something like this. We have the anti-commutator of sigma I plus with sigma I z, and then some other stuff that's multiplied by it. And this thing here is equal to zero. So we could similarly check that this anti-commutator of CI and CJ dagger is delta IJ. And if we did that, we would find that it works. And the procedure is basically the same, so I'm not going to do that again. OK, so now we can invert this. To write the sigma operators with C and C dagger, and then substitute into H. So if I want to invert it, then I get that sigma J plus is equal to a product of L less than J, sigma LZ, CJ, where I've just multiplied by this on both sides, since I just had these things all squared to one. So they've vanished on this side. And now I use my definition of this sigma Z, which I wrote down here, that's 1 minus 2n. J So we've written our raising operator as purely in terms of the fermionic operators, in terms of the C and this N operator, which is C dagger C. Okay, so now I'm going to make the change which I sort of messed up earlier. So I wrote earlier that this is minus 1 to the N, but that's okay, what I actually mean by this is that what I actually want to say is that this gives us 1 if n equals 0, and minus 1 if n equals 1. So okay, so it is indeed minus 1 to the n. And so this gives us a slightly nicer way of writing it, which is that sigma j plus is equal to product of L less than J minus 1 to the N CJ. Okay, but it's the same thing as this. So just maybe slightly clearer way of writing it. Okay, so to finish today's class, I'm just going to substitute. Sorry, go ahead.
The N that is
how this is it's in this N is as it's NL. Yeah, on whichever so this still have this infinite string. Okay, so now we can substitute this in. So sigma xj is going to go to this product minus 1 to the n times cj plus cj dagger. Sigma jy has the same piece there. But now it's equal to I just erased it, but sigma plus, so CJ minus CJ dagger times minus I, and CJZ is 1 minus 2NJ. And this implies that H is equal to minus J sum on I of CJ plus CJ dagger 1 minus 2NJ. CJ plus 1 plus CJ plus 1 dagger. Plus G times 1 minus 2NJ.
Yep. 1 minus 2NJ factor in the first length of The Hamiltonian was sigma x, sigma jx, and sigma j plus 1x.
That's right. So this came from the sigma j plus 1 from this string. So we got two of these strings. For every site to the left of j, they canceled. But then the j plus 1 piece had one term of the string which did not cancel.
I see.
Okay, so we can simplify this a little bit. We can use the fact that cj nj is equal to cj, and cj dagger nj is equal to 0. The easy way to say this is that if I'm going to apply cj, then on any state where this n was 0, then I'm going to get 0 either way. And if this n was 1, like, okay, for cj to act, my state had to have been the state where n equals 1, basically. N equals 0 state, both sides will give 0. And similarly on this side, for this piece, if I acted with the state that's already at 1, then the cj dagger will kill it. And if I act with the state that's a 0, 1, then the n will kill it. So either way, it gets killed, so it gets 0. So then I can use that to basically combine this term. So this piece will become the cj just gives, with the cj, my n is equal to 1, so this piece becomes minus 1. For cj dagger, this piece is 0, so this piece is 1. So what this becomes is minus j sum on I cj dagger minus cj times cj plus 1 dagger plus cj plus 1. Plus g minus 2g cj dagger cj. So this is our endpoint for today, which we'll pick up again in tomorrow's class. But the thought I want to leave you with is that this is indeed a perfectly valid fermionic Hamiltonian, but it now has a feature we've never seen before. If I distribute out these terms, I get a term like this. It has C dagger, C dagger. We've never seen this before because this term does not conserve particle number. It creates two particles. It doesn't destroy any particles. But that's something we should expect because if you remember, CJ dagger, erase it, but is basically the sigma minus operator. It's a spin lowering operator. And our original Hamiltonian only conserves spin mod 2. Therefore, in our new language, we only conserve particle number mod 2.
Not C dagger, C C become valid.
That's right.
Question?
Yes.
How do you know in advance that function to by this transformation, you are basically arguing that the elementary excitations in this model is fermionic. Can you do this argument?
Yeah, that's a good question. I also don't know the answer to that question. Yes, I mean, yeah, your perspective is exactly right, but I.
Can we say that the elementary excitations are spinors?
Yeah, I suppose you. That language is not usually used, so that's. Yeah, I mean, it's a good question because actually the natural picture of the elementary excitations, at least in the side where J is much bigger than H, the natural picture is actually a domain wall, which seems like it would behave in a bosonic way.
Domain walls can be both.
They could be either, that's right.
Yeah, so should be careful arguing that they are bosonic.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. Yeah. And on the other side, it's a spin flip. The other side, the basic excitation is a spin flip. Yeah, I'm not really sure how to argue that, actually.
In the bosonic case, can we have restrict only to 2D Hilbert space?
That's the Hartree boson.
Yes.
And for Hartree bosons, you cannot do the
Yeah. So there are other spin models where, yeah, the normal solution is to use to change to a representation called Schwinger bosons. But
you can either do the slate bosons or slate spin.
Yeah, that's. Yeah, okay, I think I don't know the answer to your question, actually. Maybe I think about it. We can talk about it tomorrow. But,
I think that statistics don't matter.
So what? Sorry?
Statistics doesn't matter
anymore. Yes, okay, yeah, that's... Yeah, okay. That's also a good point. Oops. Yeah, that's true. Because you can do bosonization to convert any fermion system. Yeah. So, well, in that case, I still don't know the answer to your original question, which is that why should it seem like the excitations have fermionic statistics, which is okay. Maybe I'll think about this question. It is a very good question.